Hi, this is David Sachs, and welcome to Spiritual Tools for an Outrageous World. Every week we do a little couples therapy between us and God. It's a chance to deepen and explore our most important relationship.
Okay, I'm glad you're here. We have a very interesting progression in terms of what's going on in the world, what's going on in the Torah. Of course, we know that the Torah is the blueprint for reality, so whatever is going on there is telling us what's going on in the world itself. So with that in mind, we've just left Pesach, and we just had the Parsha Achrei Mos, which introduces the idea of Yom Kippur to us. So the progression is, we were going from Pesach to Yom Kippur. And the question is, what is the escalation there, or what is the narrative there, if you will? And I'm sure you could give your own answer, but let me share with you what it means to me. Pesach means freedom. Yom Kippur means forgiveness for mistakes. And you see, the challenge of freedom is that if I move forward, if I actually am free, if I'm not enslaved, which means that I can actually make a choice on my own, doesn't that mean that I can also fail? And as such, maybe I don't want that freedom. Maybe I don't want the freedom to fail. But if we stay stuck, then we can't progress. You know, there is a comfort zone in slavery. And a lot of the time, you see in the Torah itself, the Jewish people said to Moshe, why did you take us out of Egypt? We had free food there. We had like melon and cucumbers, and you know, there was a certain structure to our lives. Freedom can mean a lack of structure, which can be scary. And that's why Reb Shlomo says that without having a plan, you're still a slave. In other words, freedom without a mission, freedom without an actual plan, is another form of enslavement. It's an enslavement to whatever you're feeling in the moment. You just become you switch masters, and then you're just a slave to whatever your whims are. So in order to be free, you actually need a plan. Now, where do you see that in the Torah? You see it in the idea that we're taken from Egypt to Mount Sinai to receive the Torah itself. In other words, we're not just free to become hedonists or whatever it is, but we're free to actually zero in on the truth of reality in an unencumbered way. So let's get back to this connection between freedom and forgiveness. God is telling us the following. Now that you're free, you will make mistakes. But guess what? I'm going to forgive you. And therefore, don't stay stuck just because you're afraid. You have to venture out. There is a plan now. And if you make a mistake, I'll forgive you. So all of this is within the idea of we're here for a purpose. And what's confusing about life is that all of us have been blessed with individuality and separate gifts. And we have to embrace those gifts as separate pathways. But they're separate pathways within a greater plan and a greater structure, which is healing the world and fixing the world. And that's what the Torah is talking about. And everyone has a share in that, Jews and non-Jews, because we're all God's children. But there actually is a truth. That's the crazy thing, because people think that the ultimate liberation is to think that your truth is the ultimate truth and everybody's truth is the ultimate truth. And there is something to that. But your truth and my truth are all subsets of one ultimate truth, which actually has a structure to it. Just like there's a structure to the universe itself, there is a structure to truth itself. Like, for instance, if you look into just science and physics and all the rest, there are laws to the structure of the universe, like how it actually came to be and the laws of physics and the reality of these things. I'll give you a very simple example. Imagine I'm playing baseball and it's sort of like, I don't really know how to play baseball, but you know, my friends are playing. It seems like a fun game. And I get up to bat and I actually hit the ball. It's like really exciting. And I run straight for third base. And the people go, no. First you run to first base. And I say, no. I want to run to third base first. And they go, but no. That's not how it's, this is not the game of baseball. First you run to first base. And I'm like, why are you being so didactic? Why are you trying to crush my truth? It's like, my friend, if you want to wear a different colored baseball cap or your own uniform and run to first base, you can do that. Express your individuality within the structure of the actual truth of the rules. If you just want to make up your own system, you're in la-la land. You're not actually living in reality. So this is the challenge to people today, where how can I embrace my own individuality and my own creativity, which, by the way, came from God, and use my own uniqueness within the service of the ultimate truth? So that takes a little bit of humility, doesn't it? Because you have to say, well, even amidst my truth, there is a greater truth, and that's God's will. Okay, so, you know, if you don't have a background, you then say, well, how do I know what God's will is? Well, the simple answer, it's the Torah. And then you say, well, how do I know the Torah is true? Okay, that's a longer discussion. But I can just tell you in a very simple way the following. Judaism is unique among all of the religions of the world, where we had, when God spoke, approximately 3 million witnesses who all heard the same thing. No other religion has the audacity to say such a thing because it can be so easily disproven. Every other major religion has one prophet who tells everybody else, trust me, and, you know, okay, you know, good luck. But 3 million eyewitnesses who all saw the same thing and who all radically changed their lifestyle, that's, how does that, just sociologically, how does that happen unless something actually occurred? And then we have a direct line of parent to child, testimony from that event. So that's the simple answer. We can go on and on and on and on for hours. How do I know? All fine and good. But that's the simplicity of it right there. Okay. So again, Pesach goes right into Yom Kippur because we have this parsha right after. It's the first thing that we're reading, which is giving us the holiday of Yom Kippur. And the connection is this. With freedom comes error, but we have to move forward, and God assures us that amidst our mistakes, there is forgiveness. So that's number one. By the way, just so you know, the parsha of Yom Kippur doesn't always come every single year after Pesach, just so you know. But it does come, and this year is one of those years where it did come, just so you know. All right, let's go further. There's something that I think is is a real blueprint for everything. If you want to see it, it's in Vayikra, also known as Leviticus, chapter 16, verse 17. And I'm just going to skip to the end of the verse here. Listen to the progression, because this progression is very, very key. He shall provide atonement for himself, for his household, and for the entire congregation of Israel. I'm going to say it again. He shall provide atonement for himself, for his household, and for the entire congregation of Israel. It's talking about the initial offerings. What I think is so resonant about that is it's telling you the following. First, you have to fix yourself. First, you fix yourself. You know, a lot of people, they discover the truth, and they can't wait to start fixing everybody else. Right? First, you fix yourself. And then, if you're lucky, you can fix your household. And then, if you're really lucky, you can fix the entire community, and then by extension, the entire world. But there is no real change. There is no real tikkun. There is no real fixing unless you begin with yourself. Reb Shlomo pointed out, when we're cleaning our houses for Pesach, chametz, the breadcrumbs, represent, at this point in the year, chametz represent basically all the evil of the world. And I hope you had an opportunity to throw your remaining bread into a fire, because to me that's maybe the highlight of the entire holiday. You're getting rid of all the evil of the world. It's unbelievable. It's an unbelievable moment. So Reb Shlomo pointed out, first you clean your own house. You don't start pointing fingers and tell everybody that they've got to get the bread out of their house. How does it begin? First, you clean your own house. That's what it is. And I have to tell you, I know people firsthand that had a real sharpness to them. I don't want to say mean, but you could perhaps use the word mean. And they started learning Torah. And they became really nice people. Or at least substantially nicer. Because they began with themselves. And the thing is that if you want to create change in other people, the type of change that really becoming a genuinely better person requires is so exhausting. I mean, it's really exhausting to become better. Because, I mean, if you're actually sincere about it, if you actually want to purify yourself, that means that you have to reroute your thought patterns. Like your neural pathways. You actually have to judge people more favorably. Which for a lot of people, that's really hard. You actually have to have a good eye. I saw the Chedushei Arim, the first Ger Rebbe, one of the greatest of the Hasidic masters, one of the greatest tzaddikim in Jewish history, said it took him 7 years to learn how to have a good eye for other people. Now, let me just tell you where he was starting from when he said it took him from 7 years. We can hope to ever be at the end of our lives of working ourselves on ourselves, to be where he was starting from before he started that 7 years. That's to have a good eye for other people. It's not easy. It's not easy to do this level of fixing. Like the Kutzker Rebbe says, before you say something, ask yourself, why am I about to say what I'm about to say? Before I do something, why am I about to do what I'm about to do? Is it for my own honor or is it for God's honor? And I can tell you something. I saw a story, and honestly, I don't remember the person and I don't even remember the story. But it's someone who did something really great. And he said, someone asked him, I guess, like, how were you able to get to such a level? And he responded back, when I have a choice between two things in my life. And what's interesting about this, because I've tried to do this, and I can tell you it's a very special thing to do. I really recommend this. When you have a choice, and we have choices all day long, and I'm not talking about, should I drown the puppy dog, or should I give a dollar to this person on the street? I'm not talking about choices like that. I'm talking about very little choices, you know, where both of them seem to be parav, so to speak. This one isn't, you know, so great, and that one isn't so great. Meaning to say it's not such a climactic, you know, contribution to the world. When you have a choice between two things, ask yourself, which one will give more honor to God? And when you start to think on that level, two things like, you know what, I want to get a drink, but I also want to go to the bathroom. Which one will give more honor to God? Well, there's a mitzvah, actually, if you need to relieve yourself to do that. Okay, so I'll do that. Then all of a sudden, when you're starting to ask yourself this question, which one is going to give more honor to God? Then you start to live in that reality that all of your actions should be for the sake of God. So the idea is this. First you fix yourself. Then you fix your household. Then you fix your community, if you're lucky. But first you fix yourself. Now, if you want to try to fix other people, what I'm trying to tell you is, it's not going to come through persuasion. It's not going to come that way. Because the level of work that the other person has to do can only be done by them if they actually want to do it. They have to want to do it themselves. So how can you inspire them to want to do it themselves? And the answer is, by being a living testimony to the beauty of realizing these things in your life. If you're a walking example of the light that comes from this type of elevation, then you yourself become just a living example. They say, well, what do you have? Whatever you have, that's what I want. What are you doing? That's what I want to be doing. And that is the greatest way to do it. And you encourage other people. You know, there's so many people, it's actually heartbreaking. They walk around doing mitzvahs, and they have this in mind. If I have to do this, you have to do it too. It's like, I can't run away from that person fast enough. Really. You know, the idea that, you know, I'm pulling this enormously horrible yoke, this heavy burden, and, you know, you better join me, because if I have to do it, you have to do it also. It's awful. Anyone with that attitude has to ask themselves, why do I feel that way? Why am I so unhappy with doing God's will? Something's off. Something is off. It may be that they took on too much too soon. I don't know. They have to talk with someone who genuinely loves them. Someone who genuinely loves them, who they respect. You know, because otherwise, it's like, I don't know who they're giving nachas to. I heard a great definition of nachas. Technically, it means rest, but it's more than rest. Rest in the sense of relief. So I heard it explained this way. When the parent didn't specifically tell the child to do a certain thing, and yet, because of the way the parent raised the child knows to do that thing on its own. And when they come to that conclusion on their own, then you have nachas, because then you realize that you pointed them in a direction and developed them in a way where they're coming to really wholesome, beautiful conclusions on their own. So, since I just told you that, I will tell you a personal story that happened to me this week where I really had nachas, you know? I remember when I first had kids, people were saying, oh, this is the best age, you know, when they're babies and everything like that. And I was thinking, you know, I actually want to have an intelligent conversation with my child. this is nice. But, you know, this to me is not the ideal. So I really looked forward to them being able to think on their own so that we can discuss things. So anyway, one of my children has a little startup and hired me to make a commercial for his company. Right? Just this is like the launch video, you know, something just really for Twitter. But it was so much fun to be in a professional relationship with my child. And he, you know, he even gave me some money. It wasn't my rate, but I wanted to do it. And I really, honestly, I've never made a commercial before. This is the first commercial, I guess, I ever made. So it was a commercial / training video, whatever. You know, it was 2 minutes. But it took a lot of work. It took a lot of work. If you know anything, I've been in television production for many, many years. And, you know, I've written for shows like The Simpsons and Malcolm in the Middle and Murphy Brown and Third Rock from the Sun. Lots and lots of shows. So I know something about making things. And one of the things that I can tell you is that you need several cuts for something to look good. The first cut looks terrible. But if you're trained and you know what you're looking for, then you know, okay, we got to cut this, we got to cut that, we got to re-record that. Okay, maybe we can put this part at the end. It's out of sequence. I mean, there are all sorts of things that if you really know how to produce something, that you do. But it takes many iterations, 5, 6, 7, 8 9 cuts, like for sure, you know? And you don't show people unfinished work. This is true across disciplines. Because what you see in it, trust me, the other person who's not trained will not see in it. And it's just, if you want to be a professional, you don't show people unfinished work, okay? Anyway, because I was given this platform that was my son's platform to post the various cuts, which were, you know, not to be seen by anyone, including him. But he had access to it, so he watched it. Which didn't make me happy, because he really shouldn't see it. Okay, anyway, we're making more cuts. Meanwhile, his big investor is pressuring him, I want to see what it looks like. And my son is telling me, he's putting on a lot of pressure on me to show him the thing. And I told my son, do not show it to him. You don't show people unfinished work. Do not show it to him. And then he says to me several more times, he keeps on emailing me, he keeps on texting me, he wants to see it. So then he tells me he saw it. I showed it to him. I said, why did you do that? Now we're getting close to the launch. And I find out that he's putting pressure on my son. This is terrible. Do not put this out. My son is in a real quandary. His top investor is telling him that I've produced a terrible piece of work and that it's going to hurt the product. Meanwhile, I keep on telling my son, this is a really good piece of work. You showed him an early cut. He doesn't know how to look at it. And in the end, my son posted it, and it got a fantastic response, exceeding all expectations. A fantastic response. And the comments were raves, people from all around the world, you know, from Europe to America to Dubai, raving about this commercial that I made. And a tremendous number of hits, of views, really. But I didn't get to the point. The point is that this guy said to his wife, you know, it's a terrible piece of work. She says, I want to see it. This is the investor's wife. He goes, I'm not going to show it to you. It's terrible. She says, I want to see it. She looks at it. She says, this is great. Then after the thing launches, he calls my son and says, I want you to know something. I'm so proud of you because you exhibited really what it takes to be a CEO, to make a tough decision and a tough call, and you made the right call, and I want you to know that I'm proud of you. But that's still not the point. Here's the point. My son said to me, I want you to know why I posted it, right? He said, number one, because you were 100% confident in the product. And number two, and this is the point, because I was afraid if I didn't, I would have violated the Torah commandment of kibud av v'em, of honoring my father. I was afraid that by not posting it, I was going to dishonor you. That's nachas. That's nachas. That's nachas. And then the fact that there was such a huge happy ending at the end, who knows, maybe just because he wanted to do this l'shem shamayim for the sake of heaven, that God gave it an extra blessing. But that blew me away. That blew me away. Okay, so I want to go deeper now. We're about to enter into the month of Iyar. Iyar is a very interesting month. It's unique among all the months of the year for the following reason. You see, there's a very interesting progression that we're in time-wise right now. We're going from Nisan, the month of miracles, where God takes us out of Egypt. But God didn't just take us out of Egypt because he wanted to give us a change of scenery or because he had mercy on us, that we had been slaves and that we were suffering. There is a higher purpose, which is the purpose of the creation of the entire world, which was to bring us to Mount Sinai and to give us the Torah. Keep in mind, when Moshe Rabbeinu gets the initial marching orders to take the Jews out of Egypt by the burning bush was located at Mount Sinai. A lot of people don't know this because it doesn't say Mount Sinai in the verse itself. It says Horeb. Horeb is another name for Mount Sinai. So God says to Moses at the burning bush, which was at Mount Sinai, take the Jews out of Egypt and bring them back here. So it couldn't be clearer that the point of leaving Egypt was to get the Torah. So much so that I just learned this. It's one of the commentaries in the Art Scroll prayer book in the Hallel section. And I was so amazed by this. I think a lot of people know that the first two days of Passover, we say the full Hallel. The remaining days of Passover, we say Hallel every single day, but we do an abridged form of Hallel. Now, there are different explanations as to why we don't say the complete Hallel, but I found this really strong. One reason is because if you said the complete Hallel, you would think that the whole purpose of Passover was just to be taken out of Egypt. The fact that we say an incomplete Hallel is because the full praise can't be said until we arrive at Mount Sinai, which was the point of leaving to begin with. I heard from Reb Eli Chaim, Reb Shlomo's twin brother. I had the privilege of being at a Seder with him many years ago. And he said in the name of the Ishbitzer the following: why do we have an egg on the Seder plate? And he said, listen, this is such a creative thought, but it's like really you just have renewed appreciation for the holy genius of the Ishbitzer Rebbe. He says, you know why you have an egg at the Seder? Because an egg is half the story. What's the other half of the story of an egg? The chicken. Pesach is just half the story, leaving Egypt. You know what the other half is? Getting the Torah at Mount Sinai. So just another visualization of it. Remember, you can't be free unless you have a plan. Pesach is the freedom. Shavuos, the receiving of the Torah, is the plan. Now you have freedom and direction. Okay, now you can fix the world. Okay, good. We have a special mitzvah, counting the Omer. From the time we leave Egypt, we're counting until we receive the Torah at Mount Sinai. Now, I'm telling you about the specialness of the month that we're about to enter, Iyar. And here's the specialness. You ready? We start counting in the middle of the month of Nisan. Okay, that means half of Nisan, there's no counting. We arrive in the beginning of the month of Sivan. Okay, it goes Nisan, Iyar, that's the month we're about to enter. Nisan, Iyar, and then Sivan. On the sixth day of Sivan, that's when we get the Torah. So we don't count the entire month of Sivan, just the beginning of Sivan, and just the end of Nisan. However, the entire month of Iyar we're counting. That is the uniqueness of the month of Iyar. We're counting the entire time. Counting and not arriving. Journeying and not getting to our destination. Longing. Yearning. Okay. Now let's put this together with another thought. Iyar is spelled Aleph Yud Yud Resh. So the rabbis teach something very special. They say it's an acrostic of the following phrase. Aleph Ani. Ani, which is God talking. I. Yud Yud is one spelling of Hashem's name. So it's I am God. The Resh stands Rofecha, your healer. Iyar stands for Ani Hashem Rofecha. I am God, your healer. That means that Iyar is the month of healing. So now this came to me over Shabbos. I want to say something for me. This is a very deep idea. How do we put these two thoughts together? That it's the month of healing and it's the month of not arriving. If you can be content that the journey is the destination, if you can be content without getting what you want, if you can be content that the search for something contains the answer because you're attaching yourself to the end, you're healed. So much of brokenness, so much of sickness comes from, I don't have what I want. But you know what I can always have? I can have my efforts to get what I want. And if from my efforts I'm drawing solace and I'm drawing nachas and nourishment and light from my efforts alone on the way to getting there, then I'm receiving healing because I'm there even when I'm not there. Now I want to say something weighty. For me anyway. In my opinion, one of the all-time greatest gematrias, you know, there's certain gematrias that are just, in my mind, just beyond. So this is one of the finalists, let's just say. Beis HaMikdash is the same gematria as Rosh Hashanah. You can check it out to the number. Beis HaMikdash, Rosh Hashanah. So the Beis HaMikdash, of course, is the holy temple in Jerusalem. And we'll know that Mashiach is here when the third Beis HaMikdash comes. So Beis HaMikdash is not just the holy temple, but it also represents the fixing of the entire world. Rosh Hashanah is the origin and the creation of the entire universe. Okay. So now let me try to explain to you the connection and how all of this fits in. We'll have to go step by step, but we'll get there. God willing. You see, the Jewish people had the Big Bang Theory thousands of years before science. Science, in truth, is still catching up with Torah. And I heard in the name of the Rambam something very amazing, which is that anybody who thinks that science disagrees with Torah is wrong, because they have the same author. The one who created the universe is also the one who created science. So if science and Torah disagree, you either don't understand the science properly or you don't understand the Torah properly. But they can't disagree because they have the same author. I'll take it another step. One of the main purposes of this world is God wanted to create a dimension where his creations had free choice. You see, angels see a quantumly higher level of revelation of godliness than we do. Because angels see such a great revelation of godliness, they are paralyzed to do anything other than God's will. In other words, angels don't have free choice, because how can they go against the God that they see so openly in front of them? By the way, angels don't see all of God. Only God sees all of God. Okay? So angels are, compared to God, radical subsets. And what are angels, by the way? Angels are just energy. They're just emanations of light. You know, so if you're thinking of statues and all the rest, you haven't got any idea what the Torah is talking about when it's talking about angels. It's just light. And it's just God, basically. It's just God reaching down into the lower worlds and sending a current of his arm, so to speak. And of course, God doesn't have any physicality. But God is just directing a thought toward a particular area to affect an outcome. So that thought, as it manifests vis-a-vis the outcome, would be called an angel. But angels can't go against God. And God thought, what if I created a creature who could go against me, but chooses not to. That would be awesome. And so God created us. But in order for us to be able to go against God, God has to conceal himself. And so we have the rules of this dimension that we inhabit. We have a dimension that's completely 100% filled with God, and yet God conceals himself in this world. God is 100% here, and yet he's concealed. So the easy example that I can offer is, imagine someone is looking for you in your house, and you're hiding in a closet. So they walk around the house and they say, "You're not here." But you are there. You're just behind the door. But where are you? "Well, I'm here." "But you mean you're not here?" No. I'm very much here. So God is very much here. He's just concealed. So people confuse concealment with abandonment. This is the big problem everybody has. They think concealment equals abandonment. Concealment does not equal abandonment. Concealment is here for one reason only, so that God can create a dimension where we have free choice. That's all. Okay. So now listen to this. What is science doing? All science is a description from God of how God does things. It's just God explaining how he runs the world in math. That's all it is. It's God's playbook. You want to know? Oh, you want to know how I do this? Here's how I do this. So God tells you how he does things, but he does it in this thing called, quote unquote, science. Now here's the hilarious part. You ready for the hilarious part? Since God wants to preserve free choice, if he tells us how he runs absolutely everything, we will lose free choice. Because we'll go, "Oh my God, like God is absolutely everywhere. He's running everything. He's in the atoms. He's in the molecules. He's running everything. Wherever I turn, there's God." We will lose free choice. But God wants to tell us his secrets. So what does he do? He creates this completely fake rivalry. Science versus God. The scientists are the ones who say there is no God. And now he can tell us all his secrets, because all the secrets are being said by the people who say there is no God, so free choice is preserved. Do you understand the genius of this? So God now has the ability to share how he runs the world in detail, because he's sharing it with the people who deny the existence of God. And now all this knowledge is available without people losing free choice. It's awesome. It's awesome. So the Jewish people, you know, Einstein had something that they called the laboratory of the mind. He would sit in his office and he would think about things. He would think about things. And then, you know, he would get up and he would see if the math corroborated what his vision, what his sense was. But it started with just kind of thinking about, what are the harmonics? How do these things harmonize? So it was really an act of creativity that he was basing his most radical advancements on. And then he had the genius to be able to show that the math supported these very creative, harmonic, sort of like understandings of reality. You know, on that point, I saw something very interesting. It was a definition of genius that I really thought was great, which is that A genius has the ability to actually see what's there. In other words, we think of geniuses like Van Gogh or like Mozart, where there's nothing there and they create something extraordinary. But there's another type of genius, like Einstein's genius, like scientific genius, where you're actually just able to see what was already there. And to describe what's there to people who were blind to it up until that moment. For maybe thousands of years, they were blind to it. And they never would have arrived at it unless you showed them what was actually there. In other words, when Einstein talks about the curvature of space, he didn't make space curved. He just opened people's eyes to relativity. Okay, so now let's get back to our point. The point is the following. The Jewish people had the Big Bang Theory thousands of years before science. Just like Einstein came up with it and then had the math, we just had the divine pipeline to understand the way it happened. And I'm cutting radically to the middle of the process, but let's just cut to what we call the Big Bang. It starts off with one infinitesimally small point of matter, and then that bit of matter expands outwards. That's what it is. Okay? That is the Big Bang, by the way. But the rabbis were saying that way, way, way back. Now, as though it's not enough to actually describe the origin of the universe, the rabbis then take it to the next step, which is awesome. They want to know, what was that point of matter? Like, wait a second. Can we even answer that question? How did you even get the first question? You're already on to another question? What was it? And then they have an answer. What's the answer? It is the foundation stone of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Holy Temple. One little bit of the foundation stone of the Holy Temple. Okay, now I want to start talking. That means, if we want to extrapolate, that means if everything is coming from that one point of matter, and that one point of matter is the foundation stone, or a bit of the foundation stone of the Holy Temple, of the Beis HaMikdash, which, remember, Beis HaMikdash is Gematria, Rosh Hashanah. We're going to get to that. That means if everything is coming from that one point, which is the foundation stone of the Beis HaMikdash, then the entire fabric of reality is one big Beis HaMikdash. That means the whole universe is one big Beis HaMikdash, one big holy temple. Now, with that in mind, I'm going to give you a kavanah to have in the morning. And this is from one of the Rishonim. You know, before the Kahanim went into the Beis HaMikdash to do the holy service, the Avodah, they would wash their hands. So here's a kavanah, which is at least 1,000 years old. When you get out of bed in the morning, the first thing that we do as Jews is we wash our hands, right? We have a washing cup, right? We wash back and forth 3 times on each of our hands. Very important to do that. He says, you can have in mind, you are like a Kohen about to do avoda, about to do service in the Holy Temple, since the entire universe is one big Holy Temple. And all of the things that you're about to do in terms of your life are going to be service like a Kohen in the Holy Temple. Beautiful. Beautiful. So expansive and so real, by the way. Okay. So now let's get to the Rosh Hashanah part. I told you that that first point of matter is the foundation stone of the Beis HaMikdash, of the Holy Temple. But Beis HaMikdash is Gematria Rosh Hashanah. And what does Rosh Hashanah mean? Rosh Hashanah means that the universe is being renewed every single moment. Which means, what is our life? Our life is that the entire universe is being created every single moment, because every single moment is Rosh Hashanah, which is the creation of the universe. And the universe that's being created around us every single moment is the Beis HaMikdash. Now let's tie it back to the previous thought. I told you, what does it mean to be healed on one very deep level? To be able to not be there yet, but to take satisfaction that the journey itself is also the destination. That means every single moment that you're on your way to doing the right thing, this is a separate entity and a separate accomplishment in and of itself, because the world is being created and exists one moment at a time. How long does it take to do something versus finishing? 99.9999% is on the way to doing something. Only one moment is finishing. That means all our lives is just the process of being on the way to doing something. So how do we enjoy the journey more? You're always supposed to quote your source. So my source is my great friend's psychologist. And he said, healthy people celebrate. Healthy people celebrate. Which means when you accomplish something, even if you don't necessarily get to the end, but if you've just sort of like reached a milestone that was hard earned, or if you actually did get to the end of something, celebrate in some way. Mark the occasion. In other words, take pleasure in your progress. And also, just to me, gratitude, the more I thank, the happier I am. And the more I just sort of like realize that I can't blink an eye, I can't lift a finger, I can't move a finger without God's help. So how am I able to do anything, actually? So anything that I accomplish, I see as a gift from God and as God sort of like being very involved in my life. And so I try to actively thank God. And not a lot of people are like, you know, the small things I'm in control of, but the big things, yeah, you know, when that happens every few months, weeks, years, then I'll thank God. I'm telling you, that's a historic blunder. It's literally a major mismanagement of your life. It's the opposite. Go out of your way to find small things to thank God for. And to, of course, talk to God. All of this is predicated on having an active, direct relationship with God, where you're talking to God like he's your best friend, like Rabbi Nachman says, where you're talking to God on an ongoing basis. And then I think that you'll realize, one thing that you'll realize is you're going to be happier because you realize you're never alone. That you are constantly with a partner, and not just a partner who's running all of reality. I mean, you have literally, as your best friend, the master of the universe, who's right there with you, listening to you, guiding you at every single moment, and giving to you all of the time. Like I like to say, our prayers are constantly being answered, we're just not praying them. And I'll give you an example of that. You wake up in the morning, you leave your house, and your car is there. Your prayer was just answered. What was your prayer? Please, God, while I'm asleep, may my car not be stolen. Your prayer was answered. You just didn't pray it. And you can apply that type of logic to almost absolutely everything that goes on. Do you know when you go to the supermarket, do you have any concept how many prayers are being answered? When you reach for the pasta, first of all, God answered the prayer, please, God, can there be something long that I can boil that becomes chewy and filling? and really accommodates different types of sauces being put on it, which are so tasty and delicious. And could it be there in a box that I can reach for? And there, can there be such a thing as a shopping cart where I can put it so that I'm not carrying it around in my pocket like a buffoon? This might be humorous, but I'm not joking in the slightest. You will never run out of things to thank God for. And when you realize that you are with, at all times, the greatest entity you could ever hope to be with, who is looking out for your good, who made you to begin with, who sustains you, who's giving everything to you every single moment, you will be happy, or at least you'll be happier. If you can tap into the reality and the satisfaction that the working itself is the accomplishment itself, then you're healed. That requires trust in Hashem. Because you have to understand that you yourself are not fully responsible for the results, only for the effort. And I know that that was a life-changing teaching for me, when I learned that God controls the results, but we are 10,000% responsible for the amount of effort we're putting in. And God's not going to let us get away with that. He's not. He's going to look very carefully. How did you use your time? How much effort did you actually put in? You know, I'll tell you, I've shared this before, but I've had success with this, and I recommend it. Before I tell it to you, it's about emailing. But before I get that, I just want to say the teaching first. If you haven't called someone twice, you haven't called them once. And you can substitute text, email, whatever it is. We're so sensitive and we're so vulnerable that if we reach out, the reaching out is so difficult for us, that when we reach out, if we don't get the response right away or in a timely way, we feel so crushed and broken, and that's our humanity speaking. I'm not being critical of it. But I am urging us to have thicker skins. Because I don't know that we can accomplish what we need to accomplish in this world unless we have thicker skins. So what's the practical bit of advice? I've seen this work because someone did it on me and it worked on me. So every once in a while I do it. I try not to do it too often, only when I really need to. If you email someone and you don't hear back, write in the subject heading before the subject, resending.
Wow.
I remember the first time someone did that to me, I shook when I saw that. And I responded right away. And again, I don't recommend you do it all the time because it creates a very powerful response in the person who sees it. And you don't want to start alienating people. But when you need to actually hear back, or it's important to hear back, especially if it's a professional thing, you can put the word resending and then you keep the same subject heading that you had before. There's so much going on in the world right now. You know, I remember using this phrase when COVID first happened. And God shut down the world, literally shut down the entire world. And I remember just going around telling people, God's busted a move. Right? God is busting a move right now. And I'm telling you, since October 7th, God is busting a move. He's absolutely, if you see the ripple effects, it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking what the ripple effects are. I mean, the fact that the levels of anti-Semitism on college campuses have been exposed, this is incredible. You know, I remember hearing for years and years, I'm sure you all did too, wow, it's really bad on college campuses. Did anybody have a clue? Did anyone even have a clue? Thank God we were alerted to this. You know, we should never know from this. We should never know from this. But if someone's diagnosed with having, you know, that thing they don't like to say the word for, here's the word you don't want to hear, inoperable. You know, you really don't want to hear that word. Because at that point, they're like, you know, just be comfortable. Try to stay positive, you know. You don't want to hear that word. If it's bad and you can still do something about it, okay, well, this is going to be painful and it's not going to be fun, but at least we've got a shot at uprooting it. That's where we're at right now. We've got a shot at redirecting college campuses, higher education. But we never would have even had a shot if we didn't know about it. Rabbi Nachman gives a piece of imagery. Imagine a pot of water and there's sediment on the bottom, but the water on top is clear. So you go, okay, well, it's clear water. And then all of a sudden you turn up the fire and the water starts boiling. And you know what happens? All of a sudden the water becomes, it goes from clear to muddy. And you don't say to yourself, wow, now I have muddy water. You realize that mud was there the entire time, you just didn't see it. And that's what's going on right now. The levels of mud and muck that were there but were just invisible to our casual eye have now been exposed. That's just one implication of October 7th. I'll give you another little bit of October 7th. How about the fact that Iran has been completely exposed as a paper tiger in terms of their missile program? I mean, it's wild. And I want to take a moment. You know, we're living in a time right now. We're living in a time right now of completely being bombarded and overwhelmed by data. And the problem is, when you're completely overwhelmed by data, all data takes on a linear quality to it, that even if something just sort of seems like amazing in the moment, you're already barraged by so much more information that you forget about it. It makes our memories very short because our minds are not expansive enough to hold on to all of the information. So even if something sort of like moved the needle and was like, wow, it's gone in a short time later. So with that in mind, what I want to just make sure that we're still talking about, because something absolutely epically historic, a miracle on the biblical level, was performed for us, and we cannot afford to forget about it. And that was the fact that Iran fired over 300 missiles, drones, and rockets at the state of Israel, and miraculously, God put out his hand and stopped all of it. This is biblical level, 6-day war, splitting of the Red Sea level, miracle. Miraculous. Not only that, but all of a sudden the curtain got pulled and we realized that there's a military alliance that we didn't even know existed, consisting of the UK, France, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, America, and Israel, who for the first time on the job work seamlessly together like one army. Never happens. Never happens. Which is just showing you the divine miracle of it. It's impossible for armies that have never worked together and done trials, all different countries, to work seamlessly together like that. Can't happen. Impossible. It did happen because God did it. Not only that, but this missile defense or this missile offense that Iran's been working on, that's been terrorizing the world, got exposed of being old tech. Junky old tech. Which is like, wow. Wow. You mean they can't defend themselves? Really? Well, that kind of changes the equation, doesn't it? Right? I mean, we were thinking, I don't know if you saw Top Gun 2. I saw it. You know, if you want a fun action movie, it's hard to do better than Top Gun 2, really, you know? And you know what the plot was? The U.S. figuring out how to take out the nuclear facilities in Iran. That was actually the plot of the movie, which is pretty bold that they did that. They didn't make up, like, Iranistan. Like, they didn't come up with some fake-sounding country, you know, where it's sort of like, well, they'll know, because it's got the word Iran in it, but it's not Iran, you know, so we're cool, you know. No one's going to blow up the movie theaters. But they didn't. They stuck to their guns. They said, this movie is about bombing the nuclear reactors of Iran. And if you watch the movie, which, again, enormously entertaining, it's all about how it's nearly impossible to do. Like, it's nearly impossible to do it. That's the whole movie. Okay? What did Israel do? Because we just have to appreciate, like, you know, just like I love to take pleasure in the way the sages think. Like we just looked at how the Ishbitzer explained the egg on the Seder table. So beautiful. Let's take a moment to just fully appreciate for a moment the Israeli military mind at work. Okay? Because there's something just divinely inspired and beautiful about this act of thinking. Let's just appreciate it, okay? Israel had to respond to this attack from Iran. And people were saying, bomb their nuclear facilities. Okay, well, there's a problem with that. If you bomb their nuclear facilities, first of all, we didn't know that we could do that necessarily. Well, seems like we could after their attack. They're going to have to bomb us back. And then we're going to have to bomb them back for bombing us back. And now all of a sudden there's a full-scale war that Israel doesn't want. And that the world doesn't want, believe me. So now Israel has this challenge. They have to restore deterrence, which means they have to hit Iran back so hard that they wouldn't even dare try to hit Israel again. But they've got to hit them back so hard in a way that Iran doesn't need to respond. Do you understand how this is like, from the military planning standpoint, this is almost impossible. How do you thread that needle? We're going to hit you so hard, you're going to be on your knees and you're not going to be able to respond because you fear us so much. But in a way where you don't feel like you have to respond at all and you're not embarrassed before the world. Where you're compelled to respond. How did they do it? Now, I've been following these things in the papers and whatnot for years. There is an anti-missile system from Russia. It's the S-300. Iran was begging Russia for this thing for years. And Russia's like, well, I don't know. You know, this is our highest tech. I don't know. I don't know if you can have it. Finally, Iran got it. And where did they put it? In front of their nuclear facilities. So they had the highest Russian tech anti-missile defense guarding their facilities. Now Israel's got to respond. If they crush the nuclear facilities, then there's going to be another volley of missiles at Israel, and then they're going to have to respond again, and that's not an option. What did Israel do? Some blessed general came up with the following plan. From outside of Iranian airspace, meaning we don't even have to get close to Iran to do this, you understand? From outside of Iranian airspace, they fired one missile which took out the entire missile defense system in front of the nuclear facility. Do you know what that says? It says, you are defenseless before us. But it was done in such a quiet way that they could say, oh, they didn't attack us. And they weren't compelled to respond. They threaded the needle. But they sent the message in the most powerful way, that at any moment we can take out anything inside your country. Because if we can take out that, we can take out anything. Which means that the Ayatollahs in Iran are vulnerable in a way that they haven't been vulnerable before. And if the Ayatollahs in Iran go, Hamas in Gaza goes, Hezbollah in Lebanon goes, the Hutus in Yemen go. Do you understand? Do you understand how everything changes from October 7th? So from the presidency of Harvard and the University of Pennsylvania to these college protests, remember, there's two things going on with these college protests. There's the protests themselves, which are very disheartening. And, you know, you say, wow, you know, colleges, like what's happening to the colleges? So you've got the protests themselves, but here's the deeper point. You've got the rest of America watching the protests. And believe me, when the rest of America sees the U.S. flag being taken down and the Palestinian flag being raised, do you know what America says? No. I was with you. I was with you to a certain point. But no. So they are really discrediting themselves, you know, in a massive way. And so that's going on too. So when I tell you that Hashem on October 7th was busting a move, we really haven't even seen the full story yet. We haven't seen it yet. It's still happening day by day in front of our eyes. So we have to continue to pray, and we have to continue to act. And I'll just sum up by saying the following. With freedom comes mistakes, but if you are positively motivated, there is forgiveness. Don't stay stuck. Don't stay stuck. Move forward. Move forward. And the entire world is being created in front of you over and over again. The Beis HaMikdash is being created in front of you over and over again. And understand, really, that the journey itself is the destination. And if you understand that your effort has completeness in it, you will receive healing. Because you'll understand that the effort that you are making is the greatest thing that you can accomplish and is beloved by God.
Thanks for listening. We do this every week, so join in again next Sunday for our new podcast, where we explore the amazingness of life. And review us and send in any comments or suggestions. I'd love to hear them.